it's not one of those ones you analyze. It's one of those ones you kind of read and live into. And then you'll start knowing what it's about. It's part of what we were talking yesterday about how God's grace and blessing and love is not parceled out to us for our own little chunks, but rather continues to grow and move into new places. And Herbert's wonderful about that, about how one thing moves to the next and does this. And it's I hope you enjoyed that. It's a wonderful poem. Today we are in 2 Corinthians 5. And we, as of yesterday when we started making it new, we've kind of moved from treasures and vessels as the key verse to anyone who is in Christ is a new creation, in terms of talking about the treasure in earthen vessels in 5:17. And we'll do part of the beginning of 5 and then go into it. And part of what we're doing today, talking about filling it up, is understanding the space and permission and room that we have, like when God gives us the treasure of ourselves, to reshape the earthen vessels so they connect with the earth and all of that, and also to understand the ways in which God continually renews that self so that the life connection can be made. And it sometimes gets filled with surprising things, and there needs to be room and space, I said, to fill it. I was thinking, last night, the psalm, Carol forgot to tell everybody what it was about, the psalm, like the Eucharist. And I hope you picked up on it, but what it was a listing of the themes from, we managed to find them back as far as 1968, of Holden during the different eras. They may have hit the last one, everybody went, oh, that's what we were doing, okay. But I hope when you, and some of them were hard to hear because people were shouting them out, but going through the list, it's amazing how many of them have to do with newness. You know, renewal, healing, the power from the inside, and words like space are in there, and space and grace and singing and all the kinds of things that have to do with openness to the life that God continually gives us. And Paul, as we get into 2 Corinthians 5 here, will be talking about exactly being in that kind of space where renewal and healing can happen, and being able to know what that renewal is, and being open enough to be filled. That's a really key thing. And we've talked about that at different times. We'll talk about that more as we get going. So let's start with 2 Corinthians 5, and then we'll do that. For we know, Paul says, if the earthly tent we live in is destroyed, we have a building from God, a house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens. Here indeed we groan and long to put on our heavenly dwelling, so that by putting it on we may not be found naked. I'm always real entertained by Paul when he gets into these passages about longing for heaven. He reminds me a lot of my grandmother. I mentioned her yesterday, I think, or day before, I can't remember. She, as I said, then died when she was 92. She'd been perfectly healthy, still lived on her own. She had an accident. But when she was about 86 or 87, she was quite ill for a time. She had some osteoporosis in her back, and it was quite serious for a while, and had to be in bed for 3 or 4 months. My entire life, I remember my grandmother, who was an immigrant to Seattle from Norway, continually over and over and over again, would say, yeah, I can hardly wait till I can go home and be with Jesus. And she would say that over and over and over and over again. Well, when she was ill, she stayed with my mother, which I'm actually surprised I didn't kill both of them, but mainly because my grandmother probably had to stay in bed, it was okay. But I was not living near them at that point, so I just would get reports. But in that about 3-4 month period, let me tell you, my grandmother never once mentioned going home to be with Jesus. It was just, get me better and get me out of this bed. Even to the extent, if she was a member of the WCTU, huh, the Women's Christian Temperance Union, one of some of my earliest memories are walking down Finney Avenue with my, or Greenwood Avenue in Seattle with my grandmother and shoving tracts under tavern doors. And let's go for a walk, Nancy, and that's what we do. That's how my ministry started. Anyway, you know, and I'd ask, you know, well, Grandma, why can't we go in and put it on the counter? I didn't know it was called the bar. Oh, no, we couldn't do that. It was terrible. But when she was ill with this osteoporosis and was in bed, what she wanted was Bock beer because that was a restorative in Norway. When somebody, you know, needed to get stronger, they gave them Bock beer. You know, and my mother reminded her of her WCTU pledge, I think. She said, here, forget it. I don't care. Just, you know, just get me out of this bed. And it worked. And, you know, she lived another 5 years, probably would have lived another few if she hadn't had an accident. But Paul reminds me of that. I mean, he waxes eloquent on, you know, longing to get out of this earthly body and be off and die and go to heaven and be with Jesus and all this. But, you know, remember what he said back there in chapter 4? Afflicted in every way but not crushed, persecuted but not forsaken, struck down but not destroyed. You know, here we go. And Paul always continually fights that battle too. And what's important about this for us is that the wonderful treasure of life that we have in ourselves doesn't want death to happen. And it's going to buck it, you know? Even no matter how much we know about life with God forever and all that stuff, what God gives us is that same sense of that same life right now, so that, let me tell you, we're going to hang around with these earthen vessels as long as we possibly can. Because we know, because of that life in us, that however bleak sometimes life on the earth looks, it's still all part of the wonder of who God is, right? And who we are in God. And there's that wonderful sense of fullness of life that we have right now and is always available to us that doesn't need to sit around and long to be with Jesus. Because we've got that right there. So, and Paul talks about this this home and this tent and all this stuff. And talks about this home stuff here, and I was thinking this is a real nice connection with Scott's sermon last night when he talked about the house. And what a wonderful connection. I mean, he reads that the Gospels, that passage from John 14, you know, that in God's house are many rooms. And when do we always hear that text read?
Funerals.
Funerals, right. You know, and it's kind of like, and so you're always thinking about in God's house are many rooms and it's off in heaven, wherever heaven is, out there or down there or up there or around there, wherever it happens to be. And all of a sudden, you know, I mean, it's almost like a landing of an alien spaceship, you know, when Scott taking a, hey, wait a minute, you know, the house with many rooms is right here, isn't it? That's an amazing connection. And essentially, Paul's doing the same kind of stuff here, too. You know, I mean, he's muttering about heaven and eternal life and all that stuff. But the life he cares about is simply God's life, which is here and it's there and it goes on forever and all that. And that's what he's doing at this point. So that, of course, gets us back into the kinds of things we started talking about yesterday. That, you know, wherever we go, we take these earthen vessels with us. And that our connection with life is much larger than in our own, quote, souls or spirits. That it's all this connection with you know, everything in the earth, indeed with the whole cosmos. We can start getting into Colossians 1 here and see how Paul talks about those connections, because they're all there. And it's that ecology Dick was helping us with yesterday. And it's that whole connection with life. I mean, if it's connected with life with God forever, then the life that God created here must also be just as potentially full. But it's also connecting with the realities of it, which are the death and decay. And one thing that it's real easy to do that I think, and I think pulls us apart from connecting with the earth, is our idealization of nature. That is, you know, humans are awful and terrible and awful, so I'm going to go out in the woods and commune with God and everything's going to be swell because the trees are perfect. Well, you know, the reality is that trees die, huh? squirrels die. Even inorganic stuff like rocks and things, you know, get ground down by water and, you know, nothing's perfect here. nothing's whole in itself. The whole creation groans together in travail. Thank you, St. Paul. And we're all connected with that whole creation. So that's all about this whole thing. So it's also understanding then the life God gives as being for the whole cosmos and all the earth. And it isn't just a matter of our souls going to heaven when we die, which is terribly un-Lutheran lingo, by the way, to even say a phrase like that. You should know that. So is this all clear? At 7:45, I had to ask people if I was actually making English sentences. I think I'm awake enough now that I might be. You know, syntax can be a problem when you're tired. Are you all there this morning? I have to ask you that again. I mean, everybody's just sort of... Okay, let's go on then. For while we are still in this tent, we sigh with anxiety, not that we would be unclothed, but that we would be further clothed, so that what is mortal might be swallowed up by life. Now, in this whole passage, Paul's going to talk about, as he was talking about at the beginning of chapter 3, my status in the world, or your status in the world, or how you look in the world, just doesn't matter diddly squat when it comes to God. And we're not worried about our own position. And that's what he's saying here. He says, what do you want? Do you want what the world gives you and what that looks like? Or do you want to be swallowed up in life and changed that way? Which clothing do you want? The world's life or God's? Take your pick. Mortal, whenever Paul uses that word, that's always about the things of the world. You know, it's always about our microwaves and... our new sweatshirts, right? And all of those, you know. So that's what he's talking about there. That it once again is this thing, you know, this notion of being swallowed up isn't a matter of disappearing. It's a matter of being taken in God's life in such a way that it transforms the treasure again. So that goes out again, like we've been talking about. Going out from the self that once again connects you with life and with everybody else. And so Paul says, the one who has prepared us for this very thing is God, who has given us the Spirit as a guarantee. The Spirit's the thing that awakens us and continually renews us daily in that kind of life. So Paul says, so we're always of good courage. We know that while we're at home in the body, we are away from the Lord. Now Paul there is not saying that means that God is somewhere off distant, and that we're here sort of fighting it out. Where does the entire New Testament tell us that God lives? Yes? Within us. Within us, right. Where two or three are gathered. I will come to you and make my home with you. You know, all that language. This is where God lived. So Paul's talking about, Paul's talking about that kind of completeness. You know, we're not doing that quite yet in the fullness of being with God in heaven. We had a great talk about heaven in 7:45. If you want to do that, that's fine. And but we're still in the rooms of the house, to borrow Scott's image from last night too, and what Paul's talking about here. It's not an issue of just sort of fighting it out here. And scrabbling through the earth until finally we emerge victorious on the other side. It's continually living day by day in this life, because he says we walk by faith, not by sight. We're not seeing Jesus out there all the time, except for in each other. We are of good courage, and we'd rather be away from... Oh, I said that one, didn't I? Away from the body and at home with the Lord. So whether we're at home or away, we make it our aim to please him. We had a good discussion at 7:45 about that verse, because somebody got real nervous about that. Does that mean then that we are, when we are with God forever? I don't like to use the word heaven, because we have so many locked in images of that, don't we? You know, playing harps and all that, and that it's up there somewhere. God lives up there somewhere, and it gets to be so separate, but. Anyway, the place where we are with God forever, And one person was saying, does that mean that we're going to have to continue to make choices and grow and develop and all that stuff? I thought that was going to be over then. And we started talking about that and thinking about how, one, when we read, we make it our aim to please God. Our immediate reaction is to have a big checklist about what I'm going to do to please God today, right? Isn't that, maybe I'm the only one that does that. I don't think so. Oh, dear. Am I doing it? Am I pleasing God? And so that makes us nervous when we think about if we have to do that with God forever. And Paul's not talking about it that way. It's kind of like living in the pleasure of God now and also when we're with God forever. And when you think about all the passages, there's piles of them in the scripture where God delights in people, takes pleasure in us. You know, takes so much pleasure in us that God sent Jesus to reconcile us. There's a great delight in humanity. I mean, terribly, for a lot of frustration, too. God, there they go again. And there's kind of this, but there's this wonderful delight that God has in us. And sort of sharing in that whole thing is part of what Paul's talking about here. And one phrase I thought about between that Bible study and this one about that verse was that, have you all seen the movie? Yeah, at least once. You should see it more. Chariots of Fire from 10 years ago, whenever. That's not quite that long. 6 years ago. Wonderful movie, right? And remember Eric Little, the Scottish missionary, and who's running. And he's a wonderful example of what we've been talking about. That is, of living out of the true treasure of yourself and not letting yourself be constrained into something else. Because you remember the issue there, and especially between him and his sister, is that he's not supposed to be running. He's supposed... You all know the plot, basically, of Chariots of Fire about these two athletes that go to the Olympics in 19... When? Huh? 20s, 22 or something like that. Yeah, it's in the 20s. And it's after World War One. That's right. And... you know, and he's supposed to be doing these meetings for young people, you know, and telling them about Jesus and stuff. And she's real upset that he's out there running all the time. And if you remember, those of you seen that they have a conversation, they go for a walk one day and have a conversation about this. But then at the very end of the movie, when Eric Little finally gets to run his race, and they show it, and he starts going, and then he goes in slow motion, and they repeat two things he'd said. And they both fit with one is, where does the power come from to run the race to its end? From within. And then, the next thing he says is, and this is where he throws his head back and, you know, runs with his hair, it's great. And, it is great. I mean, and Ian Charlson, that played him, really did a marvelous job of really making that character. You really felt connected with it. The guy who played Harold, Ben Cross did too, but Arthur Ben, yeah. That, and he said, then they repeat the conversation he had with the sister, which is, Jenny, I know that God made me for a purpose, but God always also made me fast. And when I run, I feel God's pleasure. That's a wonderful statement about how we're supposed to be in the world. And this guy, and also, if you remember the movie, this person, he abides by a principle. And it's a terrible, it's probably, you know, he's not going to run on the Sabbath, period. But there was something in him where that was a real true statement of his self. It wasn't just acceding to a rule that he had to follow. There's a real truth about him doing that out of himself, which is really important. And that's one thing the movie's about as well. So, but that's just a wonderful statement. And I think all of us out of ourselves have to, like with this, our aim to please God, is knowing that whatever that truth is that God's given us in ourselves, so that when whatever it is we do, whether it's our running or whatever, that we feel God's pleasure. And I think you know that kind of when it happens, when it's just kaboom, you know. It's a right and true thing. It may only happen once in your life, but that's worth it, okay. You know, but that's the kind of renewal that God gives us so that we can be in that pleasing connection with God.
Don't you think we are recognizing that a little bit more in our churches than
yes.
we used to? As we talk about the gifts that we've been received, it kind of used to be that if you were really serving God, you had to do the thing that you hated doing.
Exactly.
That was sacrifice, and that was really being humble. And I love the change that says, if God made you good at teaching children, then that's what you do. But you don't have to feel guilty if you don't teach in Sunday school because you're a rotten teacher. God
yeah,
didn't give you
that's
that
right.
gift.
That's right.
It gives you a freedom and a joy.
And also allowing people to not only recognize their own gifts, but to let those gifts be present in our communities. You know, so that the community itself naturally develops its whatever those people are. Instead of saying we have to do da, 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 da. And now how are we going to cram folk into that? And you end up with a lot of people doing stuff they really could care less about and are not good at. So that's another thing. And that's almost the harder piece. That's what we were talking about the other day when we were talking about sitting around and seeing what's going to happen. Impossible for congregations. But it may be what's important to do. And just what Peggy's saying, so that also those gifts emerge. And you can find out what the truth is about your community. It may be something completely different than what the other Lutheran church down the block's doing. Different folk, different treasures, different gifts. And another thing, Peggy, especially when you mentioned Sunday school, that I thought of was that we also get worried about people doing the same thing year after year. And I think that comes out of the old thing of having people doing things they didn't like. The thing is, it's okay if somebody teaches Sunday school for 30 years if they're good at it, isn't it? And they want to keep doing it. You don't need to apologize to that person for the fact that they always sign up for Sunday school. Great. I mean, think of all the wonderful, nurturing teachers that children have had because they love doing it. Heavens, yeah.
I think sometimes in our churches we forget that there's some of the treasures people have, and so if we have this vacancy, we need a Sunday school superintendent. It's the first warm body that comes along who will say yes to the position, and it doesn't necessarily, you know, people don't necessarily consider what their gifts or treasures are.
Exactly.
I mean, that doesn't mean they're going to be bad, but, you know, could we be better, you know, served with somebody else?
Yeah, and taking the time to do that is, especially when you need a Sunday school superintendent. Well, a couple of people woke up out there, so we'll keep going. Verse 10, I'll just read through it and then we'll go on. For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ so that each one may receive good or evil according to what has been done in the body. Verse 11. Therefore, I don't want to tell verse 10. Knowing the fear of the Lord, we persuade people. But what we are is known to God. I mean, that's a wonderful statement Paul makes. It's back like the beginning of chapter 3 where he says, I don't need a resume and 5 references. The living God is in your presence. That's enough. Somebody at the early Bible study mentioned Paul at one point says, I must decrease so God may increase. Paul's there not talking about losing his self, folks. He's talking about the fact that the important thing is the presence of God. And if Paul was the preacher that brought that presence in by the preaching of the gospel into that community, Paul is not the important person there. It's God that comes to the people in terms of the gospel. And Paul's saying that here too, you know. Although we persuade people, but we're just known to God, and that's the most important knowing. But then Paul, too, is a human being, and he says, I hope it is known also to your conscience. You know, he doesn't quite give up that little thing. We are not commending ourselves to you again, but giving you cause to be proud of us, so that you may be able to answer those who pride themselves on a human's position and not on the heart. And so, you know, Paul's saying this, isn't this convenient that Paul's saying the same thing I've been saying all week? It's so affirming. Anyway, but the point is that not looking at the, you know, the outside earthen vessels the way it's painted by society or whatever it looks like. No, it's not the thing. Or what kind of status you have in your community or what job you have or even what you do in your church. It's rather, no, it's on the heart. And Paul's saying that the gift that Paul has in being present among them is that is helping the people in Corinth also to have that same sense of the presence and articulation of the gospel in themselves, so that when somebody comes to them just worrying about worldly position, that person can honor that person for their heart. You know, we talked about New Age a little bit yesterday and about sort of the frustrations and pressures of the physical world, that a lot of people are caught up in that, and so the only way they can figure out to do it is to have this transcendent experience. You know, get out of it for a while. And they get back into it again, and they get out of it for a while again. And Paul's saying the way you avoid that with focus by paying, letting them know that there's treasure in them. That they have heart, and that it's, and that heart is the thing that then transforms the pressures and frustrations of worldly class and position and possessions. I think we're learning more and more and more about in our society, and it's a very good thing we are, about abuse of people, either physically or sexually or emotionally. And and a person who's abused becomes completely self-protective. You have to, otherwise you're going to die. I mean, it just becomes a matter of pure survival. So it's this kind of thing. And people who have been abused need somebody to come in, and so they've got their outside protections, and it's almost as bad as material possessions and position. As strong, a block to getting in. And they need to be just told. And also, their treasure hasn't been nurtured. So it's just, it's whatever they've got left in there. And holding on. And the general reminder that they really are a self, that they really have a treasure in this beat-up earthen vessel, that they have a heart that belongs to them, and that God can bring renewing power for that. You know, that's an amazing thing. It's the kind of gift you have to bring. It isn't just a matter of, well, okay, now, you know, you're out of that abusive relationship, you're going to be fine, you go get some therapy and do that. If you have friends or if it's you or whatever, it needs constant nurture and attention to let you know that there really is treasure there. And that it can be continually renewed, also sustained by that, and that eventually you can stand this way, instead of this way, and be connected in life with other people. That's part of what Paul's talking about here. For if we are beside ourselves, it is for God. If we're in our right mind, it is for you. Paul was probably accused of being a little rambunctious in his zeal for preaching the gospel. And so he's saying, don't worry about what we're doing someplace else to get him to pay attention. And if you're hearing sort of strange reports, that's fine. We're just fine. When we talk to you, everything, you know, we're sane here. We're in our right minds. You're getting the straight stuff. This is a positive discussion. You know, that's good. So he talks about how this all happens. For the love of Christ controls us, because we are convinced that one has died for all, therefore all have died. And Christ died for all, that those who live might live no longer for themselves, and that is kind of within themselves in this self-protection thing, but rather for Christ, who for their sake died and was raised. So Paul's talking, using more images about this earthen vessel stuff and connecting us with the earth and all kinds of things in terms of the house we live in, which is part of, in, has in its room that eternal place with God, but we still live in the same house right now. It's all there. And talks a lot about, you know, new clothing and all kinds of newness that continually happens for us and living within God's pleasure. But mostly it's that in sense of ourselves have been are continually renewed because of the love of Christ that gives us the place of self in the first place, and out of that treasure then we can do it, and God continually then fills that up with all kinds of new things that just increases the treasure of ourself so that we can make even better connections with life. I think for those of you that listen to people's, as I do very often in a pastor's position, listen to the story of people's pain a whole lot. And that can be really draining. It's very draining. And but it's a real privilege at the same time. Because when you learn finally how to listen to their story and being able to, and then being able to affirm for them that underneath all that pain there really is a self. You know, it is draining. I mean, you have to go sleep for 3 days sometimes, but it's a really special place to be. It's a really important place to be. And it's important that people be able to tell those stories that allow anybody of us can do that, that allow their self to be seen. And it might take some time sometimes, and so that can be honored and connected. But knowing too that you can listen without losing your own or getting bulldozed or by that too. Am I making sense? I'm sort of muttering. So because we're continually filled by each other's presence, whether that's in pain or in joy, and by that connection with other selves in life and in doing things. And sometimes that, it gets painful and frustrating, and not everything can be fixed. And a lot of us like to do that. Not everything is healed in this world. And not everyone is renewed. It's part of the other tragedy of our world, isn't it? And but I think as Christian people, we have an obligation and a responsibility. Isn't it awful how those words just pop into your brain? I'm sorry. But part of our calling in the life God gives us is to allow ourselves the permission to be renewed so that we can be connected in life with other people for their renewal as well. So on those notes, you're also quiet today. Yeah. Oh, good, Leroy, good. Somebody else is going to talk here.
Paul seems to, of course, indicate that this earthen treasure is going to be of any value with for self or for others. It has to be filled, as we say.
Right, today, yeah, right.
With the Holy Spirit. But, you know, that whole process, how does it happen? I thought of what Scott said last night, his emphasis on contemplation. Mm-hmm. I get the feeling he's going to try to allow more of that personal contemplation here. And really, there are those quiet moments as you're reading, as you're just meditating, that the Holy Spirit does begin to have some effect of what's running constantly, doing all of the things, even to improve in the congregation. I'm wondering if we shouldn't give an opportunity in our congregations for more time for contemplation in our Bible studies. Maybe we give just a brief outline and then let people sit for a bad idea. 15 minutes. You know, even in Sunday morning, there's so much activity in a worship service, you can't really contemplate very much. on maybe what the Spirit wants to do for him. I don't know.
I think that's a really good point. And Lutherans, we are so verbal. You know, I mean, there's a good reason why, you know, the word is central to matters of faith and life. And it becomes words, right? Sometimes. We're real verbal, and we don't like quiet time much. And especially to be in a group and be quiet is like... But that kind of thing is really important. But we also know that it is word that fills us also. That it's that when we come to church on Sunday morning, that we go there with an expectation to be, or not just an expectation, with a promise that there something's going to happen that's going to renew us, right? I hope that's why you go to church on Sunday morning. Well...
But how does that happen?
Yeah, Jill, huh? I think it happens.
There's been a lot of dependence upon the preacher and the preaching of the word. And if you just happen to be in a church where maybe that isn't your leader's strongest points, you are looking for other ways for that to happen. And that is a question I'd like anybody who'd like to address, because if you get into a church where the emphasis is on doing and doing and doing and doing and being busy and doing all these things, and, where does that renewal come from?
Good question. It may come, it probably doesn't come out of the busyness. It might, though. Some people do get it out of being busy. You have to honor that, like Peggy was saying about the gifts, which is... I'll get myself on tricky ground here. I mean, we're about taking risks here, right? But no, I'm not taking a risk. It's something I firmly believe. And when you mentioned that, what if the pastor in your congregation, the chief word bringer, is not gifted as a preacher? And Peggy was talking back there about how the church has gotten people into places where they didn't have gifts. It's something we've done in the professional leadership of our church all the time. What generally in the Lutheran church is the way to serve God professionally? It's to get ordained, right? Well, because of that, a heck of a lot of people over the years have gotten ordained that never, ever should have been pastors. When somebody comes to me and asks, talks about wanting to go to seminary, my first question is, do you want to preach? Are you called to preach? If they say no, I say, don't go. Or don't go to be ordained. And if you don't feel called or want or have a desire, they get into that whole calling stuff, and people worry about lights in the night and stuff like that. it's not that. But the call to be pastor is a real basic one. It's to preach the word and administer the sacraments. Period. And out of that center, a lot of other stuff happens. But that's the center of it. And, I don't think you should go home and ask your pastor to leave the ministry, but... or maybe I do. No! But I think we need to pay attention to that with all this gift stuff, is understanding the way in which we want people... to do things. And there are people that, we do care about that. We do care about, as Lutheran Christians, we care about that proclaimed God. We come to church to hear the gospel. We care enough about it that we structure into our congregations a way to pay somebody to do that so that they have the freedom to do the, we're supposed to have the freedom to do the reflection, to have the quiet time, to do the conversations with folk. That allows the gospel to happen in the community and to be then the spokesperson for the way that gospel is happening in that community. And it's mightily important. Yeah. Am I making sense there? You understand what I'm saying there? Yeah.
You mentioned that sometimes we are comfortable doing this contemplative thing in a large group. So it seems like maybe small groups might be the answer to a lot of those needs. Mm-hmm.
I want to say one. Can I add one thing to what I was just saying? That doesn't mean a good preacher or somebody called to preach does not have to be a skilled orator. I mean, they need to be understandable, okay. But you understand what I'm saying? They don't necessarily need to be a terrifically skilled orator. Just the desire to preach and an ability to say English sentences that are understandable, yeah.
Somebody could preach. Comment about, about silence,
yeah.
And her comment about how do you get from doing to more balance and even doing contemplative things. Leads me to this observation that if you start out with a group of people and you say, now we need more silence, so we're going to have a period of silence. Now let the silence begin. The results can be disastrous because many people, most of us, don't know what to expect when we enter into silence, because what we really hear is tremendous inner noise. We begin to feel guilty. Why don't I experience silence? What is silence? And so forth. It would be as disastrous as if David were to say, all right, this morning, we're going to have a new liturgy. Sing, you know.
Yeah.
There's no chance to learn what it is.
Yeah.
Or maybe it's like the experience of doing the Holden Matins, which musically are very beautiful and also require a little training and experience. The contemplative experience is something which is both an art and a discipline and is not simply a spontaneous thing as we were led to believe glossolalia was, where just simply the spirit comes in and suddenly you begin to speak in tongues. It's not that at all. And if we listen to our Zen brothers and sisters, the Buddhist brothers and sisters who are practicing Zen, and many others, including Christian Zen people, it's something that really requires teaching and needs to come back into our educational structures so that people learn how to be present to the present moment, which involves silence and awareness and so on and so forth. It's a very, very process kind of thing. It needs to move into our whole curriculum.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Part of, I think, one reason we're getting away, people did used to know how to pray in the Lutheran Church. And they used to be able to pray in groups and have silence and do that. When I was a child, that was true. We've had a lot of confusion about prayer in the last 20 years. And so what we've done is we've shelved it.
May I have one more comment?
Yeah.
One of the experiences of contemplation is that in corporate contemplation, the power of it is really greatly magnified.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost a synergistic kind
right.
of thing. The more people you're silent with, the more powerful the silence is. So a large congregation in silence is really a very powerful place to be.
Exactly. And the point I want to make is just get back to sort of looking at where we've been a little bit. You know, we used to know how to pray. We don't know how to do that either, so there isn't even that access to get at what you're talking about. And wanting to train people to do that. But part of what we're talking about here, about understanding, you know, the full treasure of the self, and when you've got that, when you have an awareness of that, and so when you got it, when you got it all together, no, we're not talking about that. When you have that awareness of that, that also gives you permission to start learning what you're talking about. Because there's a place for all that to be. I mean, you have a place to be silent with yourself then. I think. I'm just, that makes sense, Dick? Okay, yeah.
On the other hand, one learns about oneself in silence. So.
Yes, it can also be a way of doing that, too. There's also the danger, though, of people who are on a journey in search of self, learning the contemplative disciplines and where that becomes a substitute for their self.
Yeah, yeah. That's right.
That's a danger, yeah. So.
Well, it's the rootedness in community that allows the balance.
Exactly, see. What's the big thing about being Christian? You can't do it by yourself. Can't do it by yourself. I mean, it's a given. When you hear the gospel, it leads you to other be with other people.
Awesome.
To have silence in Sunday morning, yes. So you arrange time. I mean, if it has to be learned, which I agree with what Dick's saying, then you find time for the silence to be learned. And I think I've been in large places where it's been silent and there have been children. And children are human beings that also pick up on the power of that and they shut up.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, it's amazing. That really does happen. Yeah. So I think, you know, it, when you tap into the power, it, it probably not every Sunday, you know, for 20 minutes. It's, most children won't handle that one. But I think it's possible, Doris, yeah, in what they're saying, yeah.
When you use silence, that's one of the ways of using silence, the absence of sound. And when you have a community like that and children and cars driving by and doors opening and toilets flushing and so on and so forth, you don't have that kind of silence. You have sounds that interrupt. But real silence is awareness, which includes awareness of the child that's whimpering or the rustling mm-hmm. or the bulletins or what have you. Awareness of what is and thanking God for it. There's a marvelous story that Anthony DeMello tells about this great wise person who was having difficulty praying. But the trouble was the frogs were always croaking and interrupting him. This person was so powerful that he could simply say, "Frogs, be silent." And the frogs were silent. And then he went back to his praying, only to discover that he couldn't pray. And he waited and waited and waited and became more and more frustrated and finally realized that apart from the sound of the frogs, there was not the sound of God. That the frogs were a part of the sound of life, and then the frogs began to sing again, and then he began to pray. So, neat story.
That's a neat story.
Something I just read this, it's beautiful, is what the gentleman just said, but the person who I can't remember who wrote it said that you should have your bathroom close to your worship center so that what was happening in worship would once in a while hear the sound of the toilet flushing, because that was all of connectedness of everything that was happening in the world.
We do kind of clean up, you know, we try and make our sanctuaries protected from all that stuff, don't we? And that's wrong. I mean, that's just plain wrong. I'm getting real bold here, aren't I? Yeah. Now we're getting it right and wrong.
Let's say one more thing.
Okay.
At the school where I work, we have a beautiful chapel. And it's located high up on a bluff above the Mississippi River Valley. And it has windows all on the side that face out over the valley. And all of the windows are stained. And I have this dream that we will take out all of the stained glass and put in clear glass, so that as we worship, the whole valley, the riverboats moving, and the lights and so forth, and all of the industrial stuff that's there can be seen. But the stained glass, I think, was designed to just simply protect us from the intrusions of what's out there, the noise and the movement and so forth.
Well, good luck.
I figure I've got 10 more years.
To convince them to do that, right? Can the windows, are the windows on the other side that are plain?
That's just a plain old wall.
Oh, well, gee, there's hope then. Someplace to move the windows, right? That's right. That would be, that's one of, we do that all the time, don't we? We just continually block out nature from our sanctuaries. And what we, and then what gets brought in, too. And the way we were taught as children, too. I had, actually had, well, well, we were often taught that everything around the chancel area was very holy, right? You don't go up there unless you're the pastor or the altar guild. And
or altar boy.
Or in Rome Catholic Church, an altar boy, yes. And you just don't go there. And fortunately, I think that's changing in our parishes, which is good. And actually, in my own parish, I had a conversation with somebody about that who was real disturbed about the fact that the kids kind of, when they're waiting for their folks after church, sort of play around. And it was a good, illuminating conversation for me in terms of how I've moved myself from all that stuff. And she was real upset about this, and I said, you know, it's just wooden and carpet. That's what, it's wooden carpet. I mean, just like everybody should be respectful and of other, of all kinds, they're including their own homes, in terms of caring for it and stuff, but if they're not doing any damage and just sort of playing on the carpet or something, it's just wooden carpet. When the people are gathered, God's present, but other than that, it's wooden carpet. She wasn't buying it, but I think that's a, huh?
You don't have an eternal life.
We do have an eternal life, but I'd love to get rid of it, but if it's a memory, you know, it's a memory. The Altar Guild hates it, too. They can say the thing burns down. We're spending this money on all this stuff.
There's a story that Richard Simon Hansen in his book, Worshiping with a Child, talks about a childhood memory of his, how he believed that God was in the altar.
Inside?
Inside the altar. One day he led some children with him. Nobody was around, he was going to go see God. And the revelation, you know, when he opened the doors, and there was, I don't know, offering plate or
yeah, right, yeah, right.
Inside instead of God. But it was interesting, that same era where the offerings.
So, and, you know, so we shifted. I mean, for me, it's much more important. The children in my parish feel totally at home in that place. They're not afraid to be there. They're not scared. It drives their parents crazy because they'll get up and wander around, and they'll wander up the stairs in the chancel during services, and you see this frantic parent running up the middle aisle. Come back here. But they're totally at home there. And that's much more, much more important than anything else. Jill.
It makes me think of the time that Steve was preaching at a lay service a long time ago. And our son felt so comfortable at church. He walked up to the front of the church while he's preaching. Before I realized he's out of the pew, I couldn't grab him. He sat on the steps and just sat there and listened to his daddy. And it was
great. Yeah.
I thought that was so neat.
Yeah, it's wonderful when our children feel at home.
The other thing I want to say is our mission churches. I mean, there's so much vibrancy in our mission churches. If we would just listen to what they are like. They bring their goats. They bring their chickens and their little babies. And can we even imagine what it's like to worship in that setting with all this life
and all the stuff around? Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
I think we need to keep in touch with that somehow. It helps me when it gets noisy in church to remember.
Well, I'm going to be in trouble with the tape ministry here, so I can't do that because I live in the same house as the tape ministry person. So, thank you all. We'll do this again one more time tomorrow.